Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everybody. I got a great one today, you know, for a change. And you know why? Because I finally got a guest who knows how to put two words together. Jesus, I've had some inarticulate people. Oh, I've had some extremely good-looking guests, but I keep forgetting that this is not a visual medium. It's a podcast, for God's sakes. And I finally just figured that out, and that's a real breakthrough for this podcast. So from now on, only guests with something very interesting to say. Or short of that, an interesting way of saying something that's just a little less interesting. But today, very interesting, because I have Chris Coons, the junior senator from Delaware. Junior senator, Al, junior. Why don't you have the senior senator from Delaware? No. Believe me, you wouldn't want that. That's Tom Carper. And look, I'm not going to say anything negative about one of my former colleagues. Why would I do that? Let's just say you don't want to have to listen to Tom Carper for more than 2 minutes. Okay, but Chris Coons, that's an entirely different story. And not just because he's probably the U.S. senator closest to Joe Biden. See? Delaware? Get it? Wait a minute, you're thinking. I thought Joe Biden was from Scranton, Pennsylvania. No, Biden was born in Scranton. His dad lost his job in Scranton, as the story goes, and said, "Joey, I lost my job, but everything's going to be all right. It's going to be all right, Joey. Don't worry. I'm getting out of this hellhole in Scranton and getting a job in Wilmington." "Where's Wilmington, Dad?" "I don't know. It's just supposed to be better than Scranton." Anyway, I think that's how the story goes. I don't have it exactly clear because I haven't heard the story enough times. Okay, but that's not the point here. Chris Coons, very close to Joe Biden. And not only that, but one of the Senate's most knowledgeable leaders on foreign relations, extremely knowledgeable guy on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And that's foreign relations. Not foreign affairs. Senators have relations, not affairs. And on top of COVID peaking and attendant economic and social problems attending that, the president-elect has been thrown a number of curveballs already, one in the Mideast before he even gets there, before he gets sworn in. We think it's the Israelis who killed the top atomic scientist in Iran, and that is a big deal. This very well may have been a deliberate way to complicate Biden's hand in that region. And you're not supposed to assassinate people in another country like that. And of course, that's our country's official policy. We make exceptions. We killed Soleimani, but he was a military guy and he was killing Americans and he was in Iraq. But it's very much our nation's policy not to kill foreign heads of state in their own country. That's our policy, and it's a controversial policy. People will say, "Well, hey, if we had had the chance to kill Hitler in 1939, you know, wouldn't we have done that?" And that's a good point. I suppose the response to that is, "Yeah, well, the Germans could have replaced Hitler with someone a lot worse than him." No, I did not mean that. I didn't mean that. But you're going to be hearing a great one from Delaware Senator Chris Coons in a bit. First, I want to talk about some of my other former colleagues, the Republicans. You know, I keep in touch with a few of my Republican former colleagues, and I've been texting a few of them, basically saying, come on, you got to say something. Trump is undermining our country's faith in our system of democracy. And these Republican secretaries of state are getting death threats. And it's happening all over the country. And it's, you got to say something. And you would not believe the bullshit I am getting from my former Republican colleagues on, when they text back. It'd be one thing if they had just write me back like, I can't say anything. My base is his base, and that'd just be the end of my career. And I'd write, yeah, well, you know, Americans have fought and died for our democracy, for our system. And I have written that to them, and then I don't hear back from them. That's it. That's the end of that. And but that's fine. You know, I lost a couple of those guys during the impeachment. But the damage that this is doing to our country is irreversible. The longer we have this pathetic display by this sick, sick, sick man, and I'm talking Trump, of course, the longer this goes on, the more the Republican base believes that this has been rigged, that the democracy is rigged, because that is what he is saying every day. You know, in 2016, when the Russians were interfering in our election, they didn't think they were going to defeat Hillary Clinton. They didn't think she'd lose. They just assumed she was going to win, and they wanted to undermine her, and they wanted to undermine Americans' confidence in our system. Donald Trump has done that to an extent the Russians could only dream of. And these chicken shit Republicans are doing the Russians' work for them. So before we get to Chris Coons, I want to talk about a couple other things. The runoffs in Georgia, you know, the stakes are so high there. And I know a lot of you think, oh, well, we always lose these runoffs in Georgia. We always lose them. And yeah, we do. We always have lost them. But you know why? Because we have the general election in November, and then you have this runoff in early January, and people don't know they're happening. Everyone knows they're happening in Georgia because they can't get away from it. There's been $300 million spent on ads in Georgia. And people are sick of the ads. So don't send any money to anybody who's putting up ads. Send money to the ground game. I have a PAC, Midwest Values PAC. We gave during the general election a lot of money to the Nevada culinary workers, because they're the ground operation in Nevada and under Unite Here. And they've always been the most effective ground game. They were also in Arizona. They were also in Pennsylvania. They were in Philadelphia. They got more turnout in Philadelphia than we had gotten when Barack Obama ran. That's how effective they are. And they're on the ground. They're 400 from Unite Here, and they are on the ground in Georgia. And they're really effective. And by the way, they've been on the ground. They're on the ground in general. And during all this COVID, they did the ground operation. They were very careful. This is what they did. They do not share a car. If you're a canvasser for Unite Here, you don't share a car with another canvasser. You have your own hotel room. You don't share a hotel room. Not one of these canvassers around the country got COVID because they know what they're doing. And they're really effective. And possibly a lot of Republicans won't show up because their president is telling them it's all rigged. Isn't that wonderful? Wow, what a putz he is. Woo! What a putz. There, I've said it. I know it's going to be controversial, calling Donald Trump a putz. So here's how to help unite here in Georgia. Google Take Back 2020. The first result will be Unite Here, their website. Go to that, and there you'll be able to donate to Take Back 2020. So don't give money so that more ads. No one wants to see more ads there. And I know you might be thinking, we always lose these, but look, this is the last election in the cycle. This is control of the Senate. And we have to try. And I think we can, because this one's very different than any of the other runoffs. And this is about judges. This is about confirmations of Biden's nominees. And it's about legislation. And it's about our having the majority and setting the agenda in the Senate and being able to pass legislation. This is unbelievably important. So please, if you're of a mind to do that, please do that. And also, there's all kinds of stuff to do in this season. There are food banks. People are hurting. So I talk a little bit later. I feel very emotional about this. We have not had a relief package for people because of COVID. We're finally hearing them talk about doing something, and let's hope we do it. But this has been an unbelievably hard time for a lot of folks. I want to talk about a couple other things before we get to Chris Coons. Biden won, but we did not do well down ballot. And there are a number of reasons for this, one of which is there is just a critical mass of Americans, Republicans and independents, who just went, we cannot have this guy around for another 4 years. And I was frankly surprised there weren't more, that Donald Trump got the second most votes of any presidential candidate in our history. That was just scary. And what this is about, and I've talked about it, I wrote an op-ed piece that maybe some of you are familiar with, about there's two universes of information in our country, and we have a lot of people in our country who believe that Democrats are blood-sucking pedophiles. I mean, they get their information from a whole different universe. We talked about that, Tim Kendall, on our last podcast. He was the former Facebook executive who actually was in charge of monetizing their system and came on advertising, and that's why their algorithms are designed just to keep people on, and the algorithms are smarter than we are, than any, and it's just they're getting smarter, and they have found these pernicious ways to keep you on Facebook. And part of that, with a lot of people, is appealing to their prejudices and telling them weirder and weirder, weirder stuff, and it's very, very, very dangerous. That's a big reason we have this divide. There's other things I want to talk about in this election. I mean, I follow Minnesota, obviously, very closely, and Biden won by 7 points there, but we did not do well down ballot. And we lost seats in the state House of Representatives, and we had only been down two state senators. This is an interesting story. I actually invested quite a lot with my PAC in that. We created a data operation for them, which, believe me, they needed. We are down by two state Senate seats. That's all we needed to pick up two. We'd give the governor both houses and to get this crucial legislation through that we need in Minnesota. So we were two down. We needed to pick up two. We didn't. And here's why. In Minnesota, there are two marijuana parties that have lines on the state ballot. Because Minnesota, if you have a statewide candidate in your party who gets 5% or more, that gives you a line on the ballot. So you have Republicans, Democrats, and you have the legalized marijuana party and the legalized cannabis party. You have two pro-legalized marijuana parties on the line in Minnesota. And because they siphoned off votes from DFLers, it's the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, in a couple of races, we did not get the majority. We did not pick up those two seats. We're still two down. And because of that, Minnesota will not pass in the next 4 years. These are 4 year seats, will not pass a legalized marijuana bill because of the two marijuana parties. Now, if that doesn't tell you everything you need to know about marijuana, I don't know what does. Okay. Wow. Also, one last thing. There's so much to talk about, but one last thing. President Obama incited a controversy by saying something I think is pretty obvious, that defund the police worked against us. And he's gotten some pushback from that, and he's right. That was not a good slogan. Believe me, I know this. This worked very badly for us in Minnesota, in a lot of areas, in a lot of areas. And we don't want to defund the police, I don't think. I mean, to a lot of ears, that sounds like that slogan. I'm not sure if people meant it as a slogan, but after George Floyd, the horrific, horrendous George Floyd murder, the city council in Minneapolis said they were going to defund the police. Now, that sounds like abolish the police. I don't think, maybe there are some people who want to abolish the police, but defund the police. You know, I used to say that the difference between Republicans and Democrats is that our bumper stickers always end with continued on next bumper sticker. Well, we came up with a really bad bumper sticker, defund the police. And that was used against us nationally. And I think President Obama was right in this case. Right after that happened, we had Charles Ramsey, the former police chief for Washington, D.C. and for Philadelphia, who had headed up President Obama's Police Reform Commission, which was immediately disbanded by Donald Trump. There's a lot of ways to reform the police. A lot of great ways. And that's, if you want to go back, Charles Ramsey, that's a good one to listen to. If you're going to a domestic violence dispute at midnight, bring a social worker along. One cop, one social worker. But don't send a social worker alone. Don't send a cop alone. Send a social worker and a cop. There's a whole bunch we can do. He talked about getting rid of the bad apples, but Chief Ramsey also talked about, why do we have these apple trees that are producing all these bad apples? Anyway, let's talk to Chris Coons. This is a really great one, you know, for a change. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move, or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
One of the things, of course, that I knew you from was your Foreign Relations Committee work. And I know that, you know, you're a very, very, very close advisor to the president-elect. And there's stuff happening right now in terms of the assassination of this Iranian scientist. And today was the first presidential daily brief that the president-elect got, right?
Yes.
And those are usually tailored to the interests of the president a little bit. So I'm going to, believe it or not, they released a recording of today's presidential daily brief. People have started to go rogue there. So here it is. I'll play this for you. Mr. President-elect, before we begin, I should warn you that the presidential daily brief has changed quite a bit since President Obama and you were in the White House, sir, and we'll have to wait until January 20th to revise it to your personal preferences. So here we go. Presidential daily brief, November 30th, 2020. President Donald Trump continues to be the most widely admired and feared leader in the world. He is the smartest, toughest, and most virile president in our nation's history, and has won the admiration and respect of adversaries like Great Britain and Germany and friends like Turkey, Hungary, and Russia alike. And that's it, sir. So Biden is going to be inheriting a very, very different foreign relations policy than he and Obama left.
Absolutely. One of the great challenges that President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris face is that our relationships with our vital allies have been strained. Our standing in the world, our ability to mobilize the world to act, whether it's in response to climate change or in response to threats ranging from North Korea to Iran to Russia, has been weakened. And our trade relations with the world have been tested and reshaped in ways that I don't think actually serve our security interests or promote our values. So there's a very robust agenda of things that the Biden-Harris foreign policy and national security team will have to do. And I look forward to supporting them in that important work.
And of course, this is one area where the chief executive, where the president has some running room, right? As opposed to a lot of other areas that he's going to have to deal with, especially if we don't win the runoffs in Georgia.
Historically, the president's got the most freedom to act in foreign relations. And, you know, frankly, out of all the disruptive things that President Trump did or has tried to do, the one where he was least successful was in slashing funding for the State Department, for foreign assistance. Obviously, he increased funding for the Defense Department. And so while he did things that restructured or destabilized some of our relationships, the resources remain largely there for USAID and for the State Department with good leadership, with folks who actually believe in and support our development professionals, our diplomats. I think it's possible for us to revive and sort of restore the capabilities of the State Department, USAID, MCC, a lot of other organizations critical to our place in the world. Frankly, we're going to need that because there's nothing more urgent about our work globally than rebuilding our alliances and helping the world respond to this pandemic.
Yeah, I'll get to the pandemic in a second. You were on the Foreign Relations Committee and you were ranking on Africa, and you just brought up USAID. And I remember when you led a CODEL that I was on, a congressional delegation trip to Africa, that the first thing we saw was a USAID project in Senegal, right?
Yep, we flew overnight from Andrews Air Force Base to Dakar, and then I unwisely, without giving us any time to recover, we all bundled into a small plane and went up to Saint-Louis to the very, very north of Senegal. It was over 100 degrees, and we spent hours inspecting a water irrigation sanitation project, a large-scale water infrastructure project you were a trooper, but I do remember you at one point looking at me and saying, this is the longest day I've ever had.
So. You know, it's funny because I was not going to bring this up. Yeah, we flew all night. Also, these are not luxurious trips. I think I've slept on the floor, tried to sleep on the floor of the plane. Land, and I'm thinking, okay, hotel, you know, rest up. New.
No, not really.
No. We go on some, what do we went on? Planes or helicopters, some way, way far away. And listen, you can, a human being can tour a water project while exhausted and sleepy. I learned that day and cursed you maybe during the trip. And then it was a great trip though. And I thank you for that. It was very memorable for me and Franny. I remember when we went to Ethiopia, which is really, really far away from Senegal.
It was another 8-hour trip. It's sort of the other side of the continent. I was overly ambitious on our agenda for this one, yes.
Yeah, and I remember one day where I was assigned to go out to a village. I think it was an Oromo village, where we had set up some clinic for women who were pregnant and were doing some good stuff there, and I was to visit that. And you guys had some official state lunch. And we go out there, and it's this rural village, and one of the families there made an elaborate lunch for me and Franny, which we had been told, don't eat anything.
Right.
And of course, I am not going to, they went to a lot of work, this family, and of course, we're going to eat it. So we, Franny and I have this lovely dinner. I do not like their bread. Their bread is like sponge.
It's called injera, and it is, it's an acquired taste, yes.
It's spongy. But they were wonderful. These people were wonderful. We did not get sick. All of you got sick at the official event in
Addis.
We got
desperately ill. In fact, Senator Merkley of Oregon has reminded me of this several times. We were actually north of the city of Addis, the capital. We were visiting with a group of farmers who had tripled their yield of corn by using a maize hybrid. And they went through this very elaborate ceremony, the coffee ceremony, and sort of blessed. And then they presented us with these ears of corn. To your point, we had all been instructed severely not to eat anything that hadn't been cooked and boiled and washed and sterilized. And so I made the tragic mistake of biting into the corn. And Merkley says to me, he looked over at me and said, okay, well, if Coons is doing it, I guess I should. I lost 10 pounds. He lost 15 pounds. I don't think Jeff left his hotel room for a day. And we had to get on a plane and go on to Rwanda. It was a memorable weight loss opportunity. But it was also, you know, frankly, a great chance to see the impact that hybrid is having on both Ethiopians and Americans.
And by the way, no one laughed harder than me and Franny
at
your distress. I actually thought you had gone to a formal government lunch. Maybe you had done that as well, but I did not know about the danger you had knowingly exposed yourself to, but that still makes me laugh. Anyway, so we have this, let's get to more serious stuff. Israel, it appears, we don't know for sure, has assassinated Iran's top nuclear scientist. They're not supposed to do that, are they? Do they like consult with us? Wasn't there a meeting between Pompeo, Netanyahu, and MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, just recently?
Well, Al, according to press reports, there was a clandestine meeting between Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia, the Crown Prince, and Prime Minister Netanyahu. I don't have any insight into what the topics were, but given the recent normalization of relations with the Emirates, with Sudan, and with Bahrain, I would assume that the conversation between Netanyahu and MBS was about normalization with Saudi Arabia.
And speaking of that, it's complicated now, isn't it? I mean,
very complicated.
This is a new chapter in the Middle East, and you know, there's a lot of talk, of course, about our getting back into the Iran nuclear deal, and that's good. You know, it's crazy that we got out of it, and et cetera. But it's complicated now, right? I mean, they have missiles that are very, very accurate.
Correct.
They attacked Saudi Arabia a couple years ago, took out a lot of its oil infrastructure. Yep. And we didn't respond. And tell me a little bit about that region now.
Well, the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, that's known by its acronym, the JCPOA, did accomplish some significant things. Iran destroyed its plutonium reactor at Iraq. They moved outside the country the vast majority of their enriched uranium stockpile. They decommissioned a whole series of their more advanced centrifuges, and they allowed for searching inspections by the IAEA. And as you know, I ultimately supported it, although having expressed real concerns about their missile program, their support for proxies, and what might happen as a result of the deal. In the 3 years after it, Iran did not significantly change their behavior. In fact, if anything, they increased their aggressive actions in Syria, in Yemen, elsewhere in the region, in Iraq. And in 2018, President Trump pulled us out of the agreement. Our European partners, the E3 of France, Germany, the UK, and the EU, are continuing to try and keep the deal alive, along with China and Russia, the other signatories. But Iran is now demonstrably well outside the deal in terms of how much they've enriched. They're upgrading their centrifuges. And there's been both this recent assassination of their leading nuclear scientist, and there was a mysterious bombing or explosion or fire at the Natanz nuclear research facility south of Tehran. There is widespread debate in Congress and in anticipation of the incoming administration about on what terms we should rejoin the deal and whether or not Iran can be expected to or hope to re-engage in diplomacy with us. Obviously, there's been significant changes in the world. Our relations with our European partners have been strained. And I would think at the very least, Iran would need to come back into full compliance with the deal for the United States to pursue a diplomatic path. The whole reason for the Iran nuclear deal in the first place was to stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon and to increase the so-called breakout period, the amount of time it would take if they made a decision to just abandon all restraint and race towards a nuclear weapon. How long would it take them? At the point where the deal was being negotiated, it was estimated as less than 3 months, and the deal pushed it back to a year or more. It's now back down to just a matter of a few months. And so I think, you know, Al, if nothing else, we have to find a diplomatic path with our partners and allies to find an option for how we move forward to constrain Iran's support for terrorism, its ballistic missile program, and its nuclear ambitions.
So those are tied together. And of course, the nuclear piece of that, the nuclear deal, was not tied to the other stuff because we just felt it was a benefit to mankind for them not to have a nuclear weapon. And we were going to continue to have inspectors past the 10-year window of the deal, right? But in the meantime, as you say, they have increased their activity in the region, certainly in Syria and in Yemen and other just they've been a bad actor all over the place. And it's going to be really tricky on how we negotiate to get them back into the nuclear deal. And at the same time, I suppose that would mean that we would relax the sanctions we have against them. But there are a lot of people who argue that by relaxing those sanctions, it will give them the opportunity to do far more mischief. And it's not mischief, it is vile stuff.
Well, and those are understandable and legitimate concerns. We also have upcoming elections in early 2021 in Iran. And so one of the other questions we're wrestling with is, to what extent does signaling a willingness to re-engage with Iran either strengthen or weaken the hand of hardliners versus slightly less hardliners in Iran? Obviously, the assassination of their most senior nuclear scientist both demonstrates that there are players in the region, if the reports are true that it's Israel, willing to take aggressive action to prevent Iran from a nuclear breakout. And it will probably encourage those within Iran who view diplomacy as unlikely to be successful. But you know, I haven't had a classified briefing on recent developments in Iran. That's one of the things I'm looking to get in the coming weeks.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break from Chris Coons, senator from Delaware, close friend and ally of President-elect Biden. We'll be right back.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Let's move on to domestic politics and to the Senate, because unless we win these two runoff seats in Georgia, the Republicans are going to continue to control the Senate. And this one speaks to the importance of my listeners donating to Georgia or getting on the ground there, especially Georgians who are listening. But this is going to be a monumentally difficult Senate and Congress to deal with if we don't win those two, right?
Absolutely, Al. These two special elections, which there's a variety of sort of unusual circumstances that came together for there to be two special elections for the U.S. Senate in the same state at the same time. Senator Johnny Isaacson, who was my ranking member on the Africa.
And a lovely, lovely guy, I will say.
Just a charming man.
Yes.
You know, Al, when we as senators say to people, my good friend Orrin Hatch, you know, I
we think don't mean
most,
it.
Most
we don't mean it.
Eyes, right? But in this particular case, you know, unprompted, you said of Johnny, you know, what a lovely man. He actually, despite being a conservative Republican from Georgia, despite being someone I disagreed with on a lot of important policy areas, is personally one of the kindest, most gracious people I've ever served with. And we managed to get a number of important bills signed into law under the Obama administration. He retired because of a challenge with Parkinson's.
Yep.
So there are two elections at the same time. One's a special election, one's a regular election. And in both cases, neither candidate got 50%. So there is this runoff January 5th. To your point, if we win both of them, then we're in control of the Senate. And that means a very different path forward in terms of confirmations for the Biden cabinet, in terms of judgeships and judicial nominations, and in terms of our ability to advance an agenda anything like what Joe Biden ran on. If we lose one or both of those races and Perdue or Loeffler, the currently serving Republican senators, are reelected, then it really all falls to Mitch McConnell and whether or not he's going to be reasonable and agreeable. And recent history suggests we should not be optimistic on that front. It may prevent us from confirming a single judge in the coming 2 to 4 years. It may prevent us from delivering COVID relief to the tens of millions of American families that are facing eviction, who've lost their job, who are struggling economically or personally. And it may prevent us from doing anything bold or significant on climate change, on opioid addiction, on background checks, on immigration. I will work, as you know, Al, tirelessly to try and find Republicans willing to work with me on this. But it is a lot harder when we're in the minority and when Mitch is the majority leader.
My temptation here is to go into senators and stocks and selling their stocks. And I don't think that's as important as COVID relief, which I want to talk to you about. But my God, why should any senator own any individual stock? Why shouldn't we just have been required? What I did was I had mutual fund. I had exchange based, you know, stocks like index funds and stuff like that. We had a Stock Act, right? You remember that?
Yeah.
And thank God for that, because that meant you had to disclose what you did. And that's part of the reason Perdue and Loeffler are both in trouble on this. But this is unbelievably awful. It just, remarkable that senators, apparently, I mean, by any way you look at it, these are inappropriate sales of stock using knowledge that they had. And I just don't understand. Will there be a move to say, nope, you just can't own individual stocks?
Speaking sort of broadly about ownership restrictions, you know, Al, it would make a lot of sense to me that a requirement of service in the Senate is that whatever assets you come in owning, whether it's mutual funds or properties or stocks or whatever it might be, that you have to fully disclose and set up a blind trust where whoever is managing those assets does not and cannot consult with you about things you learn through your service in the Senate. I think it will be difficult to get the whole Senate to ever agree to barring any ownership of stock. Some folks, you know, come into the Senate having been successful in business. Some come into the Senate with family businesses that they own some share of. Some come into the Senate largely penniless. One of the ways that I think Joe Biden distinguished himself in the Senate was by often being the senator with the least economic resources and never forgetting where he came from and being someone who grew up in, you know, middle-class neighborhoods of folks who worked in manufacturing. But I, you know, one of the challenges, as you know, is that any change in terms of our disclosure rules requires a majority of the Senate. And if there's one thing Mitch McConnell has fought tooth and nail, it's increasing limitations on political fundraising, limitations on disclosure by requiring greater disclosure. And I frankly think it undermines the credibility of the Senate as an institution as a whole. Many Americans own something through their IRA or their pension fund in mutual funds. Relatively few Americans own, you know, $100 million in stock, and a few of our colleagues do. And I think it just casts doubt on the Senate as a whole when you've got folks of great means and who continue to trade even during their service.
Okay, let's talk about the most urgent crisis facing us, which is COVID. And we now have some hope, which we needed. So I want to talk about, one, the vaccines, and two, I want to talk about a COVID relief package. I think it just makes me want to cry, knowing that food insecurity has tripled in this country, that we have kids who can't go to school, who don't have connectivity. We have parents who have to stay with their kids and can't go to work. This is sinful, the way we're handling this. Can we get a relief package? Can we get it soon? Can we help people?
Al, that's part of what makes it so hard for me to go back to Washington today and to try and stick out my hand and say, okay, Lindsay, okay, Susan Collins, okay, let's try again and get this done. We should have done this 6 months ago. To be encouraging, I'll remind you that in March, the Senate unanimously passed the CARES Act, which at $2.3 trillion is the single biggest bill we've passed in decades, or frankly, likely will pass in decades. It was an absolutely enormous relief package that sent unemployment checks, support for small business, significant resources to states and local governments, and invested in the development of the vaccines that are now showing huge promise so that we can move from hope to optimism to confidence that we will be out of this pandemic next year. What is maddening, Al, and to use your term, sinful, is that month after month after month, the Republican majority in the Senate has refused to move on a package anything like the scale that is needed. There's about 6 million Americans who are facing eviction or foreclosure in the coming month. At the holidays, in my little state of Delaware, the Delaware Food Bank is serving more people than they've ever served by a multiple. I was just over at one of our larger city public schools, a middle school where there was a testing available, and I was talking to the principal, and he said, you know, they are doing their absolute best to provide an educational experience, but the number of kids who don't have access to the internet, who don't have the ability because of their parents and their home conditions to really learn, he's concerned this will be a lost year in terms of education. So I do think in the next 2 weeks, we will likely reauthorize the PPP program. There's $130 billion in it that hasn't been spent yet. I do think we may well extend the date for state and local governments to spend their CARES Act relief. And I'm hopeful that we will authorize more funding for states for the distribution of the vaccine. But beyond that, another round of unemployment, another round of individual stimulus checks, I just don't think the majority leader and his caucus are going to do that. And it makes me want to cry or break things to have to say that, but that's my current sense of where we are.
Yep, me too. It's maddening. my daughter works for the DC public school system, and I got to tell you, this is insane what we're doing. let's talk about the vaccine. Someone came up with the idea, and which I think is not a bad idea, of just paying people to take the vaccine. I mean, like, the best thing can happen for our economy is for everyone to be vaccinated, and the best thing for our health, and the best thing for so that people don't die is for everyone to be vaccinated. I don't think Senator Perdue should be paid to take his vaccine. That's where I draw the line.
But essentially, the argument is, you know, get in line, here's your vaccine, great, you're vaccinated, here's $50 that you get when you come back for your second shot, because we've got somewhere between 30 and 40% of Americans, given just how much President Trump has fueled conspiracy theories and undermined confidence in science, that say they're not going to get vaccinated. And if it's a two-shot vaccination regime, which most of the promising vaccines are, you have to take the first one and then come back in 2 or 3 weeks to get the second one.
Yeah, and I don't think it's 50. I think it's 200 and then 200 for the next one. I mean, I don't know what the price point is, but we need to get everyone vaccinated. And this would pay for itself in terms of our being able to open everything up. Let's move on to something I'm really, and I know your time is short. I can't believe that my former Republican colleagues won't just say, come on, President Trump, you can't continue to question our democracy the way you are and spew these scurrilous theories. Why won't they say something? Why won't your Republican colleagues say something?
Well, so it's been an interesting journey. I've had quite a few conversations with colleagues who've called me to say, hey, Chris, I'd really love it if you'd convey my congratulations to the president-elect. And I say, well, that's great. You know, thanks for calling. Sure. but, you know, there's this thing called Twitter, and you could simply post something congratulating him on his election. And I then get a silence and I'll go on and look and I say, oh, well, you know, you haven't said anything about the election. This would be a great opportunity for you to, you know, move us in a good direction. And they backpedal and say, well, you know, my voters, my constituents believe Trump. And so we're just going to have to let this play out. There are more Republican members of Congress who have tested positive for COVID than there are who have publicly accepted that Joe Biden is the president-elect.
Before you say goodbye, I miss working with you. And it was fun on the Judiciary Committee. We sat next to each other. And thanks for doing this.
Al, you are a tremendous friend, and you are a great colleague. And I look forward to your voice and your influence and your engagement in our politics, because from the very first time I heard you bring your incredible insights and intellect and wit to bear on critiquing Rush Limbaugh and others of our era, I thought, my gosh, he could really play a significant role in our politics. You have, you are, and you will. And I've got a little sketch of the 50 states of the United States you did for me one day in Judiciary, and it's literally sitting on my desk. And I'm grateful for your friendship, and I appreciate this chance to be on with you.
You know, you can frame those things, and I'll sign it for you. That was Chris Coons, and for now on, I'm going with articulate guests who have something to say. Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.